Eli raised his hands for silence and got it. God has seen all the deeds that have been done in his name here in India. Cheering. But also on some faces uncertainty. They had seen Virlomi's vid, including the most recent one. Some of them, the brightest of them, knew that they could not be sure what Eli meant by this. And God knows, as you all know, that nothing has been done in India except by the will of General Rajam. The cheering was definitely half-hearted. Now is the day God has appointed to pay the debt of honor that is owed. The cheer had barely started when the camera crew pulled out their machine pistols and filled Rajam's body with bullets. At first, many of the soldiers thought it was an assassination attempt on the caliph, and there was a roar. Eli was glad to see that these were not the Muslim soldiers of history. Few fled from the bullets, and many rushed forward. But Eli raised his arms and strode to a higher position above the body of Rajam. At the same time, as he had instructed them, Ivan and the two men who were not holding the camera bounded up the steps and stood in line with Eli and raised their weapons above their heads. "Allahu Akbar," they cried in unison. "Muhammad is his prophet, and Eli is caliph." Again Eli raised his hands and waited until he had relative silence and the rush toward the steps had ceased. Now there were soldiers all around him. "The crimes of Andari Rajam have made a stink throughout the world. The soldiers of Islam came to India as liberators. In the name of God they came as friends to our brothers and sisters in India. But Andari Rajam betrayed God and his caliph by encouraging some of our people to commit terrible crimes. God has already declared the penalty for such crimes. Now I have come to cleanse Islam of such evil. Never again will any man or woman or child have reason to fear the army of God. I command all the soldiers of God to arrest any man who committed atrocities against the people we came to liberate. I command the nations of the world to give no shelter to these criminals. I command my soldiers to arrest any man who ordered such atrocities and any man who knew of the atrocities but did nothing to punish the offenders. Arrest them and bear witness against them, and in the name of God I will judge them. If they refuse to submit themselves to my authority, then they are in rebellion against God. Bring them to me for judgment. If they do not resist you, and they are innocent, they have nothing to fear. In every city and fortress, in every camp and airfield, let my soldiers arrest the offenders and bring them to the officers who are loyal to God and the Caliph." Eli held his pose for a long 10 seconds, while the soldiers cheered. Then he saw the cameras lowered, as some soldiers already dragged various men toward him, and others ran for nearby buildings in search of others. It was a very rough kind of justice that was going to go on now, as the Muslim army tore itself apart. And it would be interesting to see where such men as Ghaffar Wahhabi, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, aligned themselves. It would be a shame to have to use this army to subdue a Muslim government, but Eli had to act quickly, even if it was messy. He could not afford to let any of the offenders get away to plot against him. And as he watched the accused men being lined up in front of him, under the direction of Ivan and his men, who seemed unlikely to be killed today after all, Eli spoke inside his mind. "There, hot soup. See how Eli adapted your trick to his purposes. We still learn from each other, we soldiers of Ender's Jish. As for you, Peter, keep your little vid. It will never be needed, for all men are only tools in the hand of God, and I, not you, and the tool God has chosen to unite the world.
Chapter 13. Found. From Graf, pilgrimage at Kalman.gov, to P.A. Delphiki at tutsinet.rw.net. Ray, can you travel? Since your husband is busy in Rwanda right now, I wonder if you are able to travel. We expect no physical danger apart from the normal rigors of air travel, but with little Ender still so young, you will probably want to leave him behind. Or not. If you wish to bring him, we will do our best to accommodate you. We have confirmed the identity of one of your children, a daughter. Naturally, we are finding the children who share Bean's genetic condition first. We have already accessed blood samples from the child, taken at the hospital, because the birth was premature. The genetic match is absolute. She is yours. In all likelihood, this will be difficult for the erstwhile parents, especially for the mother who, like the victim of the proverbial cuckoo, has just borne another female's child. I will understand completely if you prefer not to be present. Your presence, however, might also help them believe in the reality of the true mother of their child. Your call.
Petra was furious with Peter and with Graf. These plotters, so sure they know what's best for everyone. If they were holding off on the announcement of ratification while the turmoil, no, the bloodbath, in the Muslim world continued, then why couldn't Bean come with her to pick up the first of their missing children to be found? No, that was impossible. He needed to cement the allegiance of the Rwandan military and so on, as if it really mattered. And most maddening of all, why did Bean go along with it? Since when had Bean become obedient? I have to stay, he said over and over, without any further explanation, despite her demand for some kind of justification. Was Bean a plotter, too? But not against her, surely. Why would he conceal his thinking from her? What secrets would he keep? But when it became clear that Bean would not come with her, Petra packed baby clothes, diapers, and a change of clothes for herself into a single bag, then scooped up little Ender and headed for Kayabanda Airport. She was met there by Mazer Rackham. You came to Kigali instead of meeting me there? She said.
Hello to you, too, said Rackham. We're not trusting commercial flights on this matter. We believe Ashiel's network has been broken, but we can't risk having your baby kidnapped or you harmed en route.
So Ashiel still bends us and costs us time and money, even after death. Or else he's just your excuse for making sure you supervise everything directly. Why are Beans and my children so important to you? How do I know that you, too, don't have some plan to harness our children to the yoke of some noble world-saving project? What she said aloud was, "Thank you." They took off on a private jet that pretended to belong to one of the big solar desalinization companies that were developing the Sahara. Nice to know which companies the IF is using as a cover for planet-side operations. They overflew the Sahara, and Petra couldn't help but be pleased at the sight of a restored Lake Chad and the vast irrigation project surrounding it. She had read that the desalination on the Libyan coast was now proceeding faster than evaporation, and that Lake Chad was already affecting weather in the surrounding area. But she had not been prepared to see so many kilometers of grassland or the herds of animals grazing on it. The grass and vines were turning sand and Sahel into fertile soil again. And the dazzling surface of Lake Chad was dotted with the sails of fishing boats. They landed in Lisbon, and Rackham took her first to a hotel, where she nursed Ender, cleaned herself up, then put the baby into a sling in front of her. Carrying him, she went back down to the lobby, where Rackham met her and led her to the limo waiting outside. To her surprise, she felt a sudden stab of fear. It had nothing to do with this car or their destination today. She remembered the day in Rotterdam when Ender was implanted in her womb. Bean emerged from the hospital with her, and the drivers of the first couple of taxis were smoking, so Bean made her get in the third one. He got into the first one himself. The first two cabs had been part of a kidnapping and murder plot, and Bean only narrowly escaped death. The cab she entered was part of an entirely different plot, one to save her life. "You know this driver?" asked Petra. Mazur nodded gravely.
"We leave nothing to chance," he said. "The driver is a soldier, one of ours."
So the IF had trained military personnel on Earth, wearing civilian clothes and driving limousines. Such a scandal. They drove up into the hills, to a large and lovely home, with an astonishing view of the city and the bay and, on a clear day, the Atlantic beyond. The Romans saw this place, ruled in this city. The Vandals took it, and then the Visigoths. The Moors got it next, and then the Christians took it back. From this city, sailing ships went out and rounded Africa, and colonized in India and China and Africa and eventually Brazil. And yet it was nothing more than a human city in a lovely setting. Earthquakes and fires had come and gone, but people still built in the hills and on the flat. Storms and calms and pirates and war had taken ship after ship, and yet people still put out to sea with nets or trade goods or guns. People made love and grew babies, in the mansions, just as in the tiny houses of the poor. She had come here from Rwanda, as humans had come out of Africa for 50,000 years, not as part of a tribe that climbed down into caves to paint their stories and worship their gods, not as part of a wave of invaders, but wasn't she here to take a baby out of a woman's arms? To claim that what came from this stranger's womb would belong to her from now on? Just as so many people had stood on the hills overlooking the bay and said, "This is mine now, and it always was mine, regardless of the people who happen to think it belongs to them and have held this place all their lives." Mine, mine, mine. That was the curse and power of human beings, that what they saw and loved, they had to have. They could share it with other people, but only if they conceived of those people as being somehow their own. What we own is ours. What you own should also be ours. In fact, you own nothing if we want it, because you are nothing. We are the real people. You are only posing as people in order to try to deprive us of what God means us to have. And now she understood for the first time the magnitude of what Graf and Mazur Rackham, and yes, even Peter, were all trying to do. They were trying to get human beings to define themselves as all belonging to one tribe. It had happened briefly when they were threatened by creatures who truly were strangers. Then the human race had felt itself to be one people and united in order to repel an enemy. And the moment victory was achieved, it all fell apart, and long pent-up resentments erupted into war. First the old rivalry between Russia and the West, and when that was quelled by the IF and the old Polemarch fell and was replaced by Shamrajnagar, the wars moved to different killing fields. They even looked at the battle school grads and said, "Ours, not free people, but the property of this nation or that." And now those same children, once property, were at the heads of some of the most powerful nations. Alai, mortaring the bricks of his fragmented empire with the blood of his enemies. Hanzu, restoring the prosperity of China as quickly as possible in order to emerge from defeat as a power in the world. And Verlomi, out in the open now, refusing to join any party, standing above politics, but Petra knew that she would not release her hold on power.
Hadn't Petra sat with Hanzu and Alai and controlled fleets and squadrons in distant wars? They thought they were only playing a game. All of them thought that, except Bean, the secret keeper. But they were saving the world together. They loved being together. They loved being one, under the leadership of Ender Wiggin. Rilomi hadn't been with them then, but Petra remembered her as well, as the girl she turned to when she was a captive in Hyderabad. She had given her a message, and Rilomi had taken the burden as if Petra were a real person. She had delivered it to Bean, and had helped Bean to come and save her. Now Rilomi had created a new India out of the wreckage of the old. She had given them something more powerful than any mere elected government. She had given them a divine queen, a dream and a vision, and India was poised to become, for the first time, a great power commensurate with her great population and her ancient culture. All three of them are making their nations great, in a time when the greatness of nations is the nightmare of humanity. How will Peter ever gain mastery over them? How will he tell them, no, this city, that mountain, these fields, that lake, they do not belong to you or to any individual. They are part of Earth, and Earth belongs to all of us, a single tribe. One overgrown troop of baboons that have taken shelter in the shade of this planet's night, that draw their life from the heat of this planet's day. Graf and his ilk did their work too well. They found all of the children best suited to rule, but part of the mix they selected for was ambition. And not just the desire to achieve or even surpass others, it was aggression, the desire to rule and control, the need to have our own way. I certainly have it. If I had not fallen in love with Bean and focused on our children, wouldn't I be one of them? Only I would have been hampered by the weakness of my country. Armenia has neither the resources nor the national will to rule over great empires. But Alai and Hanzu inherit centuries of empire and a sense of entitlement to rule, while Verlomi is making her own myth and teaching her people that their day of destiny has come. Only two of these great children have stepped outside the pattern, the great game of slaughter and domination. Bean was never selected for aggression. He was selected for brilliance alone. His mind far outshone any other. But he was not one of us. He could solve the strategic and tactical problems more easily than anyone, more easily than Ender. But he didn't care whether he ruled. He didn't care whether he won. When he had an army of his own, he never won a battle. All his effort was spent on training his soldiers and trying out his ideas. That's why he was able to be the perfect shadow to Ender Wiggin. He did not need to surpass Ender. All he wanted was to survive. And, without knowing it, to belong. To love and be loved. Ender gave him that. And Sister Carlotta. And me. But he never needed to rule. Peter is the other one. And he does need to rule, to surpass all others, especially because he wasn't selected for battle school. So what tames him? Ender Wiggin? Is that it? Peter must be greater than his brother Ender. He can't do it by conquest because he isn't a match for these battle schoolers. He can't take the field against Hanzu or Alai, or Bean or me for that matter. Yet he must somehow be greater than Ender Wiggin. And Ender Wiggin saved the human race. Petra stood at the edge of the hill, across the street from the house where her second child waited for her, a daughter she intended to take away from the woman who bore her. She looked out over the city and saw herself. I am as ambitious as hot soup or a lie or any of them. Yet I fell in love with and determined to marry, against his will, the only battle schooler who had no ambition of his own. Why? Because I wanted to have the next generation. I wanted the most brilliant children. Even as I told him that I wanted none of them to have his affliction, in fact, I wanted them to have it. To be like him. I wanted to be Eve to a new species. I wanted my genes to be part of the future of humanity, and they will be. But Bean will also die. I knew that all along. I knew that I would be a young widow. In the back of my mind, I thought of that all along. What a terrible thing to realize about myself. That's why I don't want him to take our babies away from me. I must have them all, the way conquerors have had to have this city. I must have them. That is my empire. What kind of life will they have with me for their mother?
We can't put this off forever, said Maser Rackham.
I was just thinking.
You're still young enough to believe that will get you somewhere, said Rackham.
No, she said. No, I'm older than you think. I know that I can't think my way out of being who I am.
Why would you want to? Said Maser Rackham. Don't you know that you were always the best of them?
She turned to him, suppressing the rush of pride, refusing to believe it. That's nonsense. I'm the least, the worst, the one that broke.
The one that Ender pressed hardest, relied on most. He knew. Besides, I didn't mean the best at war. I meant the best, period. The best at being human.
The irony of hearing him say that right after she realized just how selfish and ambitious and dangerous she was. She almost laughed. Instead, she reached out and touched his shoulder. You poor man, she said. You think of us as your children.
No, said Rackham. That would be Hiram Graff.
Did you have children? Before your voyage?
Rackham shook his head, but she couldn't tell if he was saying, no, I had no children, or no, I won't talk to you about this. Let's go inside.
Petra turned around, crossed the narrow street, and followed him through the gate of the garden and up to the door of the house. It stood open in the early autumn sunlight. Bees hummed among the flowers of the garden, but none came into the house. What business did they have in there, when all they needed was outside? The man and woman waited in the dining room of their house. A woman in civilian clothes, who nevertheless seemed to Petra like a soldier, stood behind them, perhaps watching to make sure they didn't try to run. The wife sat in an armchair and held their newborn daughter. Her husband leaned on the table. His face was a mask of despair. The woman had been crying, so they already knew. Rackham spoke at once.
I didn't want you to turn your baby over to strangers, he said to the man and woman. I wanted you to see that the baby is going home to her mother.
But she already has a baby, said the woman. You didn't tell me that she already...
Yes, he did, said the man.
Petra sat down in a chair across from the man, corner-wise from the woman. Ender wriggled a little but stayed asleep. We meant to save the others, not to have them born all at once, said Petra. I meant to bear them all myself. My husband is dying. I meant to keep having his children after he was gone.
But don't you have more? Can't you spare this one?
The woman's voice was so piteous that Petra hated herself for saying no. Rackham spoke before she could.
This child is already dying of the same condition that is killing her father and her brother. That's why they were born prematurely.
This only made the woman cling more tightly to the baby. "You'll have children of your own," said Rackham. "You still have the 4 fertilized embryos you already created." The would-be father looked up at him blandly. "We'll adopt next time," he said. "We're all very sorry," Rackham went on, "that these criminals stole the use of your womb to deliver another woman's child. But the child is truly hers, and if you adopt, you should have children that were willingly given up by their parents." The man nodded. He understood. But the woman had the baby in her arms. Petra spoke up. "Would you like to hold her brother?" She reached down and lifted Ender out of the sling. "His name is Andrew. He's a month old." The woman nodded. Rackham reached down and took her daughter out of her arms. Petra handed Ender to her.
The girl is... I call her Bella. My little Lurinia."
She wept. "Lurinia?" The baby's hair, such as it was brown. But apparently it didn't take much lightness of hair to earn the appellation blonde. Petra took the girl from Rackham's hands. She was even smaller than Ender, but her eyes were just as intelligent and searching. Ender's hair was as black as beans. Bella's hair was more like Petra's. It startled her how happy it made her that the baby took after her. "Thank you for bearing my daughter," said Petra. "I grieve for your grief, but I hope you can also rejoice at my joy." Weeping, the woman nodded and clung now to Ender. She turned her face to the baby and spoke in a small baby talk voice.
"Es tu feliz, Emterimina? Es tu felizinho?"
Then she burst into tears and handed Ender to Rackham. Standing, Petra laid Bella into the sling where Ender had been. Then she took Ender from Rackham and held him against her shoulder.
"I'm so sorry," said Petra.
"Please forgive me for not letting you keep my baby." The man shook his head.
"No ha de que disculpar," he said. "Nothing to forgive," murmured the stern-looking woman who was apparently not just a guard, but also an interpreter. The woman wailed in grief and leapt to her feet, upsetting the chair. She sobbed and babbled and clutched at Bella and covered her with kisses. But she didn't try to take the baby. Rackham pulled Petra away as the guard and the husband pulled the mother back and held her, still wailing and sobbing, while Petra and Rackham left the house. Back in the car, Rackham sat in back with Petra and took Ender out of her arms for the ride back to the hotel.
"They really are small," he said. "Bean calls Ender a toy person," said Petra.
"I can see why," said Rackham.
"I feel like a really polite kidnapper," said Petra.
"Don't," said Rackham. "Even though they were embryos when they were stolen from you, it was a kidnapping, and now you're getting your daughter back."
"But these people did nothing wrong."
"Think again," said Rackham. "Remember how we found them."
"They moved," she remembered. "When Valescu's dead man switch triggered a message, they moved."
"Why would they knowingly—" "The wife doesn't know. Our deal with the husband was that we wouldn't tell. He's completely sterile, you see. Their attempt at in vitro fertilization didn't take. That's why he took Valescu's offer and pretended to his wife that the baby was really theirs. He's the one that got the message and made up a reason for them to move to this house."
"He didn't ask where the baby came from?"
"He's a rich man," said Rackham. "Rich people tend to take it for granted that things they want simply come to them."
"The wife meant no harm, though."
"Neither did Bean. And yet he's dying," said Rackham. "Neither did I. and yet I was sent on a voyage that jumped me decades into the future, costing me everyone and everything. And you'll lose Bean, even though you've done nothing wrong. Life is full of grief, to exactly the degree we allow ourselves to love other people.
I see, said Petra. You're the Ministry of Colonization's resident philosopher.
Rackham grinned. The consolations of philosophy are many, but never enough.
I think you and Graf planned the whole history of the world. I think you chose Bean and Peter for the roles they're playing now.
You're wrong, said Rackham. Flat wrong. All that Graf and I ever did was choose the children we thought might win the war and try to train them for victory. We failed again and again until we found Ender, and Bean to back him up, and the rest of the Geesh to help him. And when the last battle ended and we had won, Graf and I had to face the fact that the solution to the one problem was now the cause of another.
The military geniuses you had identified would now tear the world apart with their ambition.
Or be used as pawns to satisfy the ambitions of others, yes.
So you decided to use them as pawns in your own game once again?
No, said Rackham softly.
We decided to find a way to set most of them free to live human lives.
We're still working on that.
Most of us?
There was nothing we could do for Bean, said Rackham.
I guess not, said Petra.
But then something happened that we hadn't planned on, said Rackham, hadn't hoped for. He found love. He became a father. The one we could do nothing for, you made him happy.
So I have to admit, we feel a lot of gratitude to you, Petra.
You could have been out there playing the game with the others.
He chuckled.
We would never have guessed it. You're off the charts when it comes to ambition.
Not quite like Peter, but close.
Yet somehow you set it all aside.
She smiled as beatifically as she could. If only you knew the truth, she thought.
Or maybe he does know. But telling her that he admires her is a way of manipulating her.
Nobody ever completely means what they say. Even when they think they're telling the truth, there's always something hidden behind their words. It was dark when she got back to her own house in the military headquarters compound just outside Kigali. Mazer Rackham did not come inside with her, so she carried both babies, Ender in the sling again and Bella at her shoulder. Bean was there, waiting for her. He ran to her and took the new baby from her and pressed his cheek to the baby's cheek.
Don't smother her, Oaf, said Petra.
He laughed and kissed her. They sat together on the edge of the bed, holding the two children, and then trading, back and forth.
Seven to go, said Petra.
Was it hard? Asked Bean. I'm glad you weren't there, said Petra. I'm not sure you would have been tough enough to go through with it.
Chapter 14 Verlomi's Visitors. From Imperial Self, Hot Soup at ForbiddenCity.ch.gov to Suriyawong at Hegemon.gov. Ray, we have found Paribhatra. Suriyawong, I am relieved to tell you that Paribhatra, the former Prime Minister of Thailand, has been located. His health is not good, but with proper attention it is believed that he will recover as well as can be expected for a man his age. The former government had nearly perfected the art of making people disappear without actually killing them, but we are still tracking down other Thai exiles. I have great hopes of finding and releasing your family members. You know that I opposed all these illegal actions against Thailand, its citizens, and its government. I have now moved at the first opportunity to undo as much of the damage as I can. For internal political reasons, I cannot release Paribhatra directly to Ambul's Free Thai Organization at this time, even though I fully expect that his group will be the core of the new government of Thailand and look forward to an early reconciliation. As we free Paribhatra into the care of the hegemon, it seems appropriate that you, who tried so hard to save Thailand, should be the one to receive him.
Verlomi came to Hyderabad, and in front of the gate of the military complex where she once worked in virtual captivity, drawing up plans for wars and invasions she did not believe in, she now built a hut with her own hands. Each day she went to a well and drew water, even though there were few villages in India that did not already have clean running water. Each dawn, she buried her night soil, even though most villages had working sewer systems. Indians came to her by the hundreds to ask her questions. When she was tired, she came out and wept for them and begged them to go home. They went, but the next morning others came. No soldiers came near her, so there was no overt provocation to the Muslims inside the military compound. Of course, she was controlling the Indian military, which grew in strength every day through her encrypted cell phones, which were swapped out daily for freshly charged ones by aides posing as ordinary supplicants. Now and then someone from another land would come to see her. Her aides would whisper to them that she would not speak to anyone who was not barefoot, and if they wore Western business suits, she would offer them appropriate clothing, which they would not like, so it was better to be clad already in Indian clothing of their own choosing. Three visitors came to her in 1 week of her vigil.
The first was Tikal Chapikar. Emperor Han had freed him, along with many other Indian captives. If he had expected some kind of ceremony when he returned to India, he was disappointed. He assumed at first that the silence from the media was because the Muslim conquerors would not allow any mention of the return of the imprisoned prime minister to India. So he went to Hyderabad to complain to the caliph himself, who now ruled over his vast Muslim empire from within the walls of the military compound there. He was allowed to enter the compound, though while he waited in line at the checkpoint, he was curious about the hut a few dozen meters away, where a great many more Indians waited in line than waited to see the rulers of the nation. "What is that hut?" he asked. "Do ordinary citizens have to go there first before coming to this gate?" The gate guards laughed at his question. "You're an Indian, and you don't know that's where Verlomi lives?" "Who is Verlomi?" Now the guards grew suspicious. "No Hindu would say that. Who are you?" He explained that he had been in captivity until just a few days ago and was not aware of the news. "News?" said one guard. "Verlomi isn't on the news. She makes her own news." "Wish they'd just let us shoot her," muttered another. "And then who would protect you as they tore us all limb from limb?" said another quite cheerfully. "So, who is she?" asked Chapikar. "The soul of India is a woman," said the one who had wanted to shoot her. He said woman with all the contempt he could put into a single word. Then he spat. "What office does she hold?" asked Chapikar. "Hindus don't hold offices anymore," said another guard. "Not even you, former prime minister." Chapikar felt a wave of relief. Someone had recognized his name. "Because you forbid the Indian people to elect their own government?" "We allow it," said the guard. "The caliph declared an election, but nobody came." "No one voted? No one ran for office?" Chapikar laughed. "India has been a democracy for hundreds of years. People run for office, people vote. Not when Verlomi asks them not to serve in any office until the Muslim overlords leave India." Now Chapikar understood everything. She was a charismatic, like Gandhi centuries ago. Rather a sad one, since she was imitating a primitive Indian lifestyle that hadn't been the rule through most of India in many lifetimes. Still, there was magic in the old icons, and with so many disasters befalling India, the people would look for someone to capture their imagination. Gandhi never became ruler of India, however. That job was for more practical people. If he could just get the word out that he was back, surely the caliph would want a legitimate Indian government restored to help keep order. After a suitable wait, he was ushered into a building. After another wait, he was brought to the anteroom of the caliph's office. And finally, he was brought into the presence. Except that the person he met with was not the caliph at all, but his old adversary, Ghaffar Wahhabi, who had been Prime Minister of Pakistan. "I thought to see the caliph," said Chapakar, "but I'm glad to see you first, my old friend." Wahhabi smiled and nodded, but he did not rise, and when Chapakar made as if to approach him, hands restrained him. Still, they did not stop him from sitting in an armless chair, which was good, because Chapakar tired easily these days. "I am glad to see that the Chinese have come to their senses and set their prisoners free. This new emperor they have is weak, a mere boy, but a weak China is better for all of us, don't you think?" Chapakar shook his head. "The Chinese people love him." "Islam has ground the face of China into the dust," said Wahhabi. "Has Islam ground the face of India into the dust as well?" asked Chapakar. "There were excesses under the previous military leadership, but Caliph Ali, may God preserve him, put a stop to that some time ago. Now the leader of the Indian rebels sits outside our gate, and we are untroubled, and she and her followers are unmolested." "So now Muslim rule is benign," said Chapakar. "And yet, when the Indian Prime Minister returns, there is not a word on television, not an interview, no car waiting for him, no office." Wahhabi shook his head. "My old friend," he said, "don't you remember? As the Chinese surrounded and swallowed up your armies, as they swept across India, you made a great public pronouncement. You said, if I remember rightly, that there would be no government in exile, that the ruler of India from then on would be, and I say this with all modesty, me. I meant, of course, only until I returned." "No, you were very clear," said Wahhabi. "I'm sure we can get someone to play you the vid. I can send for someone if you—" "You are going to hold India without a government because India has a government. From the mouth of the Indus to the mouth of the Ganges, from the Himalayas to the waves that lap the shores of Sri Lanka, the flag of Pakistan flies over a united India, under the divinely inspired leadership of Caliph Ali, may Allah be thanked for him." "Now I understand why you suppress news of my coming," said Chapakar, rising to his feet. "You are afraid of losing what you have."
"What I have?" Wahhabi laughed. "We are the government, but Virlomi rules India. You think we blacked out the news about you? Virlomi asked the Indian people not to look at television as long as the Muslim invaders retained their unwelcome presence in Mother India."
"And they obey her?"
"The drop in national power consumption is noticeable. No one interviewed you, old friend, because there are no reporters. And even if there were, why would they care about you? You don't rule India, and I don't rule India. And if you want to have anything to do with India, you'll take off your shoes and get in that line in front of the hut outside the gate."
"Yes," said Chapakar. "I'll do that."
"Come back and tell me what she says," said Wahhabi. "I've been contemplating doing the same thing myself." So Chapakar walked back out of the military compound and joined the line. When the sun set and the sky began to darken, Virlomi came out of the hut and wept with grief that she could not hear and speak to everyone personally.
Go home, she said. I pray for you, all of you. Whatever is the desire of your heart, let the gods grant it, if it would bring no harm to another. If you need food or work or shelter, go back to your city or your village and tell them that Virlomi is praying for that city, that village. Tell them that my prayer is this. Let the gods bless the people to exactly the degree that they help the hungry and jobless and homeless. Then help them make this prayer a blessing upon them instead of curse. You try to find someone less fortunate than you and help him. In helping him, you will also rise. Then she went back inside the hut. The crowd dispersed. Shapikar sat down to wait until the morning. One of the others who had been in the line said, Don't bother. She never sees anyone who spends the night. She says that if she lets people gain an advantage by doing that, soon the plain will be covered with snoring Indians and she will never get any sleep. He and several others laughed, but Shapikar did not laugh. Now that he had seen his adversary, he was worried. She was beautiful and gentle-seeming, and moved with unspeakable grace. She had mastered it all, the perfect demagogue for India. Politicians had always shouted to whip an audience into a frenzy, but this woman spoke quietly and made them hunger for her words, so she hardly had to say anything, and they felt blessed to hear her. Still, she was only a lone woman. Shapikar knew how to command armies. More important, he knew how to get legislation through Congress and keep party members in line. All he needed to do was attach himself to this girl, and soon he would be the real ruler of her party. Now all he needed was to find a place to spend the night and come back in the morning to see her. He was leaving when one of Virlomi's aides touched his shoulder. Sir, said the young man, the lady has asked to see you. Me? Aren't you Tikal Shapikar? I am. Then you're the one she asked for. The young man eyed him up and down, then knelt, scooped up some dirt, and flung it at Shapikar's suit and began to rub it in. What are you doing? How dare you? If I don't make you look like your suit is old and you have seen much suffering, then... You idiot! My suit is old, and I have suffered in exile. The lady will not care, sir. But do as you wish. It's this or the loincloth. She keeps several in her hut so she can humble proud men. Shapikar glared at the young man, then squatted, scooped up dirt, and began rubbing it into his own clothing. A few minutes later, he was inside the hut. It was lighted by three small flickering oil lamps. Shadows danced on the dried mud walls. She greeted him with a smile that seemed warm and friendly. Maybe this would go better than he had feared. Tikal Shapikar, she said. I'm glad that our people are returning from captivity. The new emperor is weak, said Shapikar. He thinks that he'll appease world opinion by letting his prisoners go. She said nothing. You've done an excellent job of annoying the Muslims, he said. She said nothing. I want to help you. Excellent, she said. What weapons are you trained to use? He laughed. No weapons. So, not as a soldier, then. Do you type? I know you can read, so I assume you can handle record-keeping in our military computers. Military? He asked. We are a nation at war, she said simply. But I'm not a soldier of any kind, said Shapikar. Too bad. I'm a governor. The Indian people are doing an excellent job of governing themselves right now. What they need are soldiers to drive out their oppressors. But you have government right here. Your aides, who tell people what to do, the one who covered me with dirt, they help people. They don't govern them. They give advice. And this is how you rule all of India?
I sometimes make suggestions. And my aides put the vid out over the nets, said Virlomi. Then the people decide whether to obey me or not. You can reject government now, said Shapokar, but some day you'll need it. Virlomi shook her head. I will never need government. Perhaps some day India will choose to have a government, but I will never need it. So you wouldn't stop me from urging exactly that course on the nets. She smiled. Whoever comes to your site, let them agree or disagree with you as they see fit. I think you are making a mistake, said Shapokar. Ah, said Virlomi, and you find this frustrating. India needs better than a lone woman in a hut. And yet this lone woman in a hut held up the Chinese army in the passes of the East long enough for the Muslims to have their victory. And this lone woman led the guerrilla war and the riots against the Muslim occupiers. And this lone woman brought the Caliph from Damascus to Hyderabad in order to seize control of his own army, which was committing atrocities against India. And you're very proud of your achievements. I am pleased that the gods saw fit to give me something useful to do. I've offered you something useful, too, but you refuse. You've offered me humiliation and futility. He stood to go. Exactly the gifts I once had from your hand. He turned back to her. Have we met? Have you forgotten? You once came to see the battle school graduates who were planning your strategy. But you discarded all our plans. You despised them, and followed instead the plans of the traitor Achille. I saw all your plans. No, you saw only the plans Achille wanted you to see. Was that my fault? I thought they were from you. I foresaw the fall of India as Achille's plans overextended our armies and exposed our supply lines to attack from China. I foresaw that you would do nothing except futile rhetoric, like the monstrous act of appointing Wahhabi as ruler of India, as if the rule of India were yours to bequeath to another in your will. I saw, we all saw, how useless and vain and stupid you were in your ambition, and how easily Achille manipulated you by flattery. I don't have to listen to this. Then go, said Virlomi. I say nothing that doesn't play over and over again in the secret places in your heart. He did not go. After I left, to notify the hegemon of what was happening so that perhaps my friends from battle school could be saved from Achille's plan to murder them all. When that errand was done, I set up resistance to Chinese rule in the mountains of the East. But back in battle school, led by a brilliant and brave and beautiful young man named Sayagi, the battle schoolers drew up plans that would have saved India if you had followed them. At risk of their own lives, they published it on the nets, knowing that Achille would let none of it get to you if they submitted it through him. Did you see the plans? I was not in the habit of getting my war plans from the nets. No. You got your plans from our enemy. I didn't know that. You should have known. It was plain enough what Achille was. You saw what we saw. The difference is we hated him, and you admired him, for exactly the same traits. I never saw the plans. You never asked the most brilliant minds in India for a shred of advice. Instead, you trusted a Belgian psychopath and followed his advice to make unprovoked war on Burma and Thailand, pouring out war on nations that had done no harm to us. A man who embraces the voice of evil when it whispers in his ear is no less evil than the whisperer. I'm not impressed by your ability to coin aphorisms. Sayagi defied Achille to his face, and Achille shot him dead. Then he was foolish to do it. Dead as he is, Sayagi has more value to India than you have ever had or will ever have in all the days of your life. I'm sorry he's dead, but I'm not dead. You're mistaken. Sayagi lives on in the spirit of India. But you are dead, Tikal Shatakar. You are as dead as a man can be and still breathe. So now it comes to threats. I asked my aides to bring you to me so I could help you understand what will now happen to you. There is nothing for you in India. Sooner or later, you will leave and make a life for yourself somewhere else. I will never leave. Only on the day you leave will you begin to understand Satyagraha. Peaceful non-compliance, willingness to suffer yourself and in person for a cause you believe is right. Only when you are willing to embrace Satyagraha will you begin to atone for what you have done to India. Now you should go. Shapikar did not realize anyone had been listening. He might have stayed to argue, but the moment she said those words, a man came into the hut and drew him out. He had thought they would let him go, but they didn't. Not until they led him into the town and sat him down in the back room of a small office and brought up a notice on the nets. It was his own picture, a short vid taken as the young man tossed dirt onto him. "Tikal Shapikar is back," said a voice. The picture changed to show Shapikar in his glory days, brief clips and stills. Tikal Shapikar brought war to India by attacking Burma and Thailand without any provocation, all to try to make himself a great man. Now there were pictures of Indian victims of atrocities. Instead, he was taken captive by the Chinese. He wasn't here to help us in our hour of need. The picture of him with dirt being flung on him returned to the screen. Now he's back from captivity, and he wants to rule over India. A picture of Shapikar talking cheerfully with the Muslim guards outside the gates of the compound. He wants to help our Muslim overlords rule over us forever. Again with the dirt flinging. How can we rid ourselves of this man? Let us all pretend he doesn't exist. If no one speaks to him, waits on him, shelters him, feeds him, or helps him in any way, he will have to turn to the foreigners he invited into our land. That was when they ran the footage of Shapikar turning the government of India over to Wahhabi. Even in defeat, he invited evil upon us. But India will not punish him. India will simply ignore him until he goes away. The program ended with, of course, the dirt-flinging picture. "Clever setup," said Shapikar. They ignored him. "What do you want from me so you won't publish that piece of trash?" They ignored him. After a while, he began to rage and tried to fling the computer to the ground. That was when they restrained him and put him out of doors. Shapikar walked down the street, looking for lodging. There were houses with rooms to rent. They opened the door when he called out, but when they saw his face, they closed the doors again. Finally, he stood in the street and shouted, "All I want is a place to sleep and a bite to eat. What you would give a dog." But no one even told him to shut up. Shapikar went to the train station and tried to buy a ticket out, using some of the money the Chinese had given him to help him make his way home. But no one would sell him a ticket. Whatever window he went to was closed in his face, and the line moved over to the next one, making no room for him. At noon the next day, exhausted, hungry, thirsty, he made his way back to the Muslim military compound, and after being fed and clothed and given a place to bathe and sleep by his enemies, he was flown out of India, then out of Muslim territory. He ended up in the Netherlands, where public charity would support him until he found employment.
The second visitor followed no known road to come to the hut. Rilomi merely opened her eyes in the middle of the night, and despite the complete darkness, she could see Sayagi sitting on the mat near the door. "You're dead," she said to him. "I'm still awaiting rebirth," he said. "You should have lived," Rilomi told him. "I admired you greatly. You would have been such a husband for me and such a father for India." "India is already alive. She does not need you to give birth to her," said Sayagi. "India does not know she's alive, Sayagi. To wake someone from a coma is to bring them to life as surely as a mother brings forth life when she bears a baby." "Always have an answer, don't you? And the way you talk now, like a god. How did it happen, Rilomi? Was it when Petra chose you to confide in?" "It was when I decided to take action." "Your action succeeded," said Sayagi. "Mine failed." "You should not have spoken to Ashil. You should simply have killed him. He said he had the building wired with explosives. And you believed him? There were other lives besides mine. You escaped in order to save the lives of the battle schoolers. Should I then have thrown their lives away?" "You misunderstand me, Sayagi. All I say now is, either you act or you don't act. Either you do the thing that makes a difference, or you do nothing at all. You chose a middle way, and when it comes to war, the middle way is death. Now you tell me. Sayagi, why have you come to me?" "I haven't. I'm only a dream. You're awake enough to realize that. You're making up both sides of this conversation." "Then why am I making you up? What do I need to learn from you?" "My fate," said Sayagi. "So far, all your gambits have worked, but that's because you have always played against fools. Now a lie is in control of one enemy, Hansu another, and Peter Wiggin is the most dangerous and subtle of all. Against these adversaries, you will not win so easily. Death lies down this road, Rilomi." "I'm not afraid to die. I've faced death many times, and when the gods decide it's time for me to..." "See, Rilomi, you've already forgotten that you don't believe in the gods." "But I do, Sayagi. How else can I explain my string of impossible victories? Superb training in battle school, your innate brilliance, brave and wise Indians who awaited only a decisive leader to show them how to act like people worthy of their own civilization. And very, very stupid enemies. And couldn't it be the gods who arranged for me to have these things? It was an unbroken network of causality leading back to the first human who wasn't a chimp, and farther back to the coalescing of the planets around the sun. If you wish to call that God, go ahead. The cause of everything, said Rilomi, the purpose of everything, and if there are no gods, then my own purposes will have to do. Making you the only god that actually exists. If I can call you back from the dead by the power of my mind alone, I'd say I'm pretty powerful. Sayagi laughed. Oh, Rilomi, if only we had lived, such lovers we could have been, such children we could have had. You may have died, but I didn't. Didn't you? The real Rilomi died the day you escaped from Hyderabad, and this impostor has been playing the part ever since. No, said Rilomi. The real Rilomi died the day she heard you had been killed. Now you say it. When I was alive, not one little kiss, nothing. I think you didn't even fall in love with me until I was safely dead. Go away, she said. It's time for me to sleep. No, he said. Wake up. Light your lamp and write down this vision. Even if it is only a manifestation of your unconscious, it's a fascinating one, and it's worth pondering over, especially the part about love and marriage. You have some cockeyed plan to marry dynastically, but I tell you the only way you'll be happy is to marry a man who loves you, not one who covets India. I knew that, said Rilomi. I just didn't think it mattered whether I was happy. That's when Sayagi left her tent. She wrote and wrote and wrote. But when she woke in the morning, she found that she had written nothing. The writing was also part of the dream. It didn't matter. She remembered. Even if he denied that he was really the spirit of her dead friend and mocked her for believing in the gods, she did believe and knew that he was a spirit in transit and that the gods had sent him to her to teach her.
The third visitor did not have to have help from the aides. He came walking in from empty fields, and he already wore the garb of a peasant. However, he was not dressed as an Indian peasant. He wore the clothing of a Chinese rice paddy worker. He placed himself at the very end of the line and bowed himself to the dust. He did not move forward when the line moved forward. Every Indian he allowed to pass in front of him, and when dusk came and Verlomi wept and said goodbye to all, he did not go. The aides did not come to him. Instead, Verlomi emerged from the hut and walked to him in the darkness carrying a lamp. "Get up," she said to him. "You're a fool to come here unescorted." He stood up. "So I was recognized. Could you have possibly looked more Chinese? Rumors are flying. But we're keeping them off the nets for now. By morning, there's no controlling it." "I came to ask you to marry me," said Han. "I'm older than you," said Virlomi, "and you're the Emperor of China." "I thought that was one of my best features," said Han. "Your country conquered mine." "But I didn't. I gave the captives back, and as soon as you say the word, I'll come here in state and get down on my knees in front of you, again, and apologize to you on behalf of the Chinese people. Marry me." "What in the world do relations between our nations have to do with sharing a bed with a boy that I didn't have all that high an opinion of in battle school?" "Virlomi," said Han, "we can destroy each other as rivals, or we can unite, and together we'll have more than half the population of the world." "How could it work? The Indian people will never follow you. The Chinese people will never follow me." "It worked for Ferdinand and Isabella." "Only because they were fighting the Moors, and Isabella and her people had to fight to keep Ferdinand from trampling on her rights as Queen of Castile." "So we'll do even better," said Han. "Everything you've done has been flawless." "As a good friend recently reminded me, it's easy to win when you're opposed by idiots." "Virlomi," said Han. "Now, are you going to tell me that you love me?"
"But I do," said Han. "And you know why? Because all of us who were chosen for battle school, there's only one thing we love and one thing we respect. We love brilliance and we respect power. You've created power out of nothing."
"I've created power out of the love and trust of my people."
"I love you, Virlomi."
"Love me?
And yet you think that you're my superior."
"Superior?
I've never led armies in battle. You have."
"You were in Ender's Jeesh," said Virlomi. "I wasn't. You'll always think I'm less than you because of that."
"Are you really telling me no? Or merely to try harder? Or come up with better reasons or prove my worth in some other way?"
"I'm not going to set you to a series of lovers' tests," said Virlomi. "This isn't a fairy tale. My answer is no. Now and always. The dragon and the tiger don't have to be enemies. But how can a mammal and an egg-laying reptile ever possibly mate?"
"So you got my letter?"
"Pathetically easy, Cipher. Anybody with half a brain could get it. Your code was just to type an obvious version of your nickname with your fingers moved one row higher on the keyboard.
And yet, only you, of all the thousands who accessed the net, figured out it was from me." Virlomi sighed.
"Just promise me this," said Han.
"No."
"Hear the promise first," said Han. "Why should I promise you anything?"
"So I don't preemptively invade India again?"
"With what army?" I didn't mean now. What's the promise you want me to make? That you won't marry a lie, either. A Hindu? Marrying the caliph of all Islam? I never knew you had such a sense of humor.
He'll offer, said Han.
Go home, Han. And by the way, we saw the choppers arrive and let them pass. We also asked the Muslim oppressors not to shoot you down, either.
I appreciated that. I thought it meant you liked me, at least a little.
I do like you, said Virlomi. I just don't intend to let you diddle me.
I didn't know a mere diddle was on the table.
Nothing's on the table. Back to your chopper, boy emperor.
Virlomi, I beg you now. Let's be friends, at least.
That would be nice. Someday, maybe.
Write to me. Get to know me. She shook her head, laughing, and walked back to her hut. Hanzu walked back out into the fields as the night wind rose.
Chapter 15. Ratification. From Radagasta Bellini, privato at presid.ncia.br.gov, to Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov. Ray, please consider carefully. If your goal is to establish world peace, my friend, why would you begin our constitution with a deliberate act of provocation against two widely separated nations, one of which might call upon the whole weight of Islam against you? Is peace to be founded on war, after all? And if you did not have Julian Delfiki commanding 100,000 friendly African troops, would you attempt it? From Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov. 2. Radagasta Bellini, privato at presid.ncia.br.gov. Ray, we must make it real. History is strewn with the corpses of attempted world governments. We must demonstrate immediately that we are serious, that we are capable, and that we are transformative. And without Delfiki, I would follow your more prudent counsel, because I would not count on our African troops.
The ceremony was simple enough. Peter Wiggin, Felix Starman, Klaus Boom, and Radagaste Bellini stood on the platform in Kiage, Rwanda. There was no attempt to bring in crowds of citizens to cheer. Neither was there any kind of military presence. The audience consisted entirely of reporters. Copies of the Constitution were provided on the spot. Felix Starman explained the new government very briefly. Radagaste Bellini informed them of the unified military command. Klaus Boom explained the principles under which new nations would be admitted to the free people of the earth. No nation will be admitted that does not already provide human rights, including a free and universal adult franchise. Then he dropped the bombshell. Nor do we require that a nation already be recognized by any existing nation or body of nations, provided it meets our other requirements. The reporters murmured to each other as Peter Wiggin walked to the dais, and the map appeared on the screen behind him. As he named each country that had already secretly ratified the Constitution, it was lighted in pale blue on the map. South America provided the largest swaths of blue, with Brazil lighting up half the continent, along with Bolivia, Chile, Ecuador, Suriname, and Guyana. In Africa, the blue was not so dominant, but it represented most of the African nations that had maintained stability and democracy for at least 100 years. Rwanda, Botswana, Cameroon, Mozambique, Angola, Ghana, Liberia. No two ratifying nations bordered on each other. No one missed the fact that South Africa and Nigeria were not participating, despite their long record of stability and freedom. Nor did anyone fail to notice that no Muslim nation was included. In Europe, the map was even sparser. The Netherlands, Slovenia, Czechland, Estonia, and Finland. Elsewhere, blue was rare. Peter had hoped the Philippines would be ready for the announcement, but at the last minute the government chose to wait and see. Tonga had ratified. So had Haiti, the first nation where Peter's abilities had been tested. Several other small Caribbean nations were also blue.